Good morning. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, February 4th.
Really into it. Over on your sheet.
Today is a day for public hearings on bills. We don't have any informational sessions scheduled for today. Public hearing on House Bill 2504.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2504 comes from Multnomah County. It expands the appropriation for the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission to $410,000, kind of resets the base and then increases the annual percentage increase from 3% to 4%, and it also expands the types of revenues that they could receive.
Thank you. We have two people signed up to testify, Taylor and Craig. Taylor signed up first. We'll start there.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I actually just wanted to sign myself up first so I could introduce Craig Gibbons. He's the Executive Director of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, and he will go ahead and explain to you a little bit more about what the TSCC is, and then after Craig's done, I will explain what House Bill 2504 does, and we'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. And would you please state your full name for the record?
Taylor Seenblock from Multnomah County.
Thank you, Taylor.
My name is Craig Gibbons. Hello, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, and members of the committee. My name is Craig Gibbons, and I am the Executive Director for the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, or the TSCC. I am here today to ask your support on House Bill 2504, which increases the budget and inflation caps for the commission and other commissions like mine. I will inform you of what the TSCC does, and my colleague Taylor Steenblock will tell you in more detail about the bill. TSCC serves citizens, school districts, and local governments in Multnomah County in the areas of local budget law and property tax. It employs 2.2 employees. The commission staff are experts in budgeting and taxation, and we provide oversight to local budgeting processes. The TSCC also provides budgeting and tax information to citizens and offers classes in budgeting and local tax law. Typical of one of our classes is the presentation you had last Monday on property taxes. We do the same thing in Multnomah County. I'd like to explain why this seemingly local issue is before you today. The TSCC is a public agency created by the legislature in 1919. Its five-member governing board is appointed by the governor. Its budget and inflation caps are determined by state statute. However, it is funded by contributions from the 29 local member jurisdictions, and the only local jurisdictions benefit from the services that we provide. Currently, we rely solely on the budget that is set in statute. We are unable to apply for grants, and we were not able to charge for services to non-member jurisdictions, though we do provide services with tax and budgeting advice, and we provide classes that non-member jurisdictions are able to attend. The TSCC has always underspent its budget by about an average of $25,000. But projected status quo expenses will cause us to exceed our budget by 2021. PERS costs and the need to offer competitive wages to attract qualified personnel are the main reasons for this exceedance. 90% of our expenditures are personnel-related expenditures. We have no way to curb these expenses. Should House Bill 2504 fail to pass, we would be forced to cut our already small team of 2.2 employees, and our basic functions would be cut similarly. The passage of House Bill 2504 would not only mean that we could remain within our budget, but give us the ability to apply for grants and charge for services would mean that we could upgrade our technology and implement new programs to increase government transparency and remove barriers to accessing this information. The result would be an overall better experience for our customers locally and for other tax supervising district customers across the state. Thank you for your time. Taylor will now discuss the details of the House bill.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Taylor Seenblock, for the record, here from Multnomah County. And as Craig said, I'll go ahead and explain a little bit more about what House Bill 2504 entails. But first of all, I want to explain, so the TSCC was created in 1919, and since then, there have been other periodic budget fixes similar to this one through state statute. The current cap, which is $365,000 with a 3% annual inflation cap, was set a decade ago in 2009. And while the TSCC technically is its own independent body, it's linked closely to Multnomah County's increases in wages and other employee costs. And as Craig stated, competitive wages and PERS costs are continuing to rise for the county as well as for the TSCC. This has contributed to the fact that they will exceed their budget, hopefully not, though, if this bill passes. House Bill 2504 would help them avoid a budget shortfalling, and it would also allow them to be more sustainable in the future. While drafting this bill, the TSCC circulated a petition to all 29 member jurisdictions, and all 29 member jurisdictions signed that petition in support of House Bill 2504. House Bill 2504 has four major components, and the first one, which we've already discussed, is it would increase the TSCC's budget cap from $365,000 a year to $410,000 a year, which is an annual increase of only $45,000. This funding comes entirely from the member organizations, so there's no revenue impact from the state. And I would also like to add that actually Multnomah County foots half of this bill, but we are happy to do so because of the services that we receive from the TSCC. The second component is that this bill would increase the annual inflation rate from 3% to 4%. We've done some analysis on inflation rates for the TSCC and discovered that 4% is a more accurate rate, and it would allow the TSCC to maintain its budget and be more sustainable in the future. The third component is that this bill would allow the TSCC to charge non-member jurisdictions for services they provide. There are 41 jurisdictions within Multnomah County, 29 of which currently pay into the TSCC, but all 41 are allowed to benefit from the services that TSCC provides, as Craig was discussing earlier. And finally, this bill would allow the TSCC to apply for grants. And in my conversations with Craig, he's told me of a couple of different grants they found specifically that would allow people to access the information for budgets and for the taxes that Multnomah County and the TSCC track. And a lot of the time, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, technology is evolving so quickly and people are accessing information in so many different ways now, but it's very challenging to keep up with what the public needs and especially what the customers need if we're not able to get grant funding, or the TSCC is not able to get grant funding to constantly gain new tools and understand what their customers really need. So we believe that with the ability for the TSCC to charge for services and apply for more grants, they would be able to have a more sustainable budget in the future, and they would also be able to really meet the customers where they're at. And as Multnomah County has stated before, we're very committed to addressing inequality and inequities, and we believe that access to information and access to services and removing barriers to those benefits is a huge part of addressing inequities. And so in this specific situation, we're very hopeful that the TSCC can provide more information to its member districts, but also the citizens of Multnomah County who are hoping to learn more about what our county does for our constituency. With that, we're happy to take any questions, and I would really be happy if we could get some support for House Bill 2504. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Smith Warner, and then Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for being here and explaining this bill that I am the official sponsor of much better than I ever could have. I have just a couple. Is there somewhere in the materials a list of the 29 member organizations?
We do have a list. I am happy to provide that to your office.
Thank you. If you could submit that for OLIS, I think that would be useful. And then my second question is, the ability to get the grants and to charge non-member organizations, would that be on top of the increase in the budget number, or would that still have to come in under that expanded budget number?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, and the committee. Currently, the budget that the TSCC gets from taking dues from their member organizations is what supports their personnel costs and any operational costs. The grant funding and the additional charging for services would be on top of the budget, but what they're planning to do with that is increase other programs such as public access to information, maybe website developments, or other things that the public would benefit from as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming this morning. I'm just trying to understand the program a little bit better. So are there any state dollars involved, or is the state just set the cap of the budget that you can then go out and charge member organizations and get through grant money?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Reschke, the state is the one that sets the cap. We collect all of our financial dues and whatnot from local member jurisdictions.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you're thinking of going outside of the 29 or the current jurisdiction to more jurisdiction, will that increase your staff, or are you going to stay the same at 2.2? And the reason I ask is you brought forth the reason that you need to raise the cap is because of personnel costs. So if you add more personnel to serve a larger population or a larger group, then we're going to be back here again shortly.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke. If we go out for grants or if we charge for services, those would be on top of our base budget. And any of the costs associated with doing those things would be on top of our base budget. It may require us to add staff, but the staff would be directly connected with the grant and the charging for services. So it's sort of a two-tiered program where our 2.2 FTE stay within our budget and anything else goes on top of it. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
There is no one else signed up to testify on 2504. I'm closing the public hearing on that bill. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2118. Is there anything you want to say to introduce this, or we're ready for testimony? Thank you. Please introduce this bill for us.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2118 replaces a now discontinued version of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, with a new or ongoing version that exists within, so we can update the statute to link to that.
Thank you. I have one person signed up to testify, Mr. Miller.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm special counsel to the State Court Administrator. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department, which includes the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, the Circuit Courts, and the Office of the State Court Administrator. The reason I'm here this morning is we have our own bill, Senate Bill 186, which has already passed off of the Senate floor, that is similar to this bill. In fact, sections 1 through 3 of Senate Bill 186 are identical to sections 2 through 4 in House Bill 2118. There are two significant differences between the bills that I wanted to raise with you today. In our bill, Senate Bill 186, we have an emergency clause, and the reason for that is that the state court administrator is charged by statute to make adjustments to the Oregon tort claims limits by July 1 of each year. So we need to have the change in place more quickly than House Bill 2118 would. It would go into effect on January 1, 2020. The other significant change is that we have a specific clause or a specific section in Senate Bill 186 that states that if the bill passes, it does not, it applies only to adjustments that we make after January 1 of this year, so that we don't have to go back and make adjustments to all of those limits that we've done over the years. You should have some written testimony in OLIS from Phil Lemon on this issue. There's probably at least three different ways to address how to resolve the difference between the bills. One would be a conflict amendment. Another would be to remove sections 2 through 4 from House Bill 2118. And another would be to add those two provisions on the emergency clause and the applicability to 2118. And I defer to legislative counsel on how they would prefer to handle that. But I wanted to raise those issues with you so that you could understand the interplay between these two bills and the importance of Senate Bill 186 to us. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of impact or revenue will this have, this bill have, if it's passed?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, it will not affect revenue. This, I can't answer on House Bill 2118 because okay. It's such a large bill and there's so many as 38 sections, and so I haven't studied that part. I can tell you on Senate Bill 186 it will have no impact because what it does is it affects the rights of people who have sued the state and the amount that they can recover, which is, you know, money that they may receive for injury, but it is not revenue to the state.
Okay. Any other questions? Signed up to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2118. I'm opening a hearing on House Bill 2388.
Okay, good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2388. My name's Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, House Bill 2388, we do have a dash one amendment. I'll get to that in just a second. But what the bill's doing to underline is it's making a change to Oregon subtraction for deposits into Oregon 529 college savings accounts. So there is some information in the background of the SMS that talks about the subtraction itself. There are limits on what you can subtract from taxable income when you make a deposit into the 529 account. These are annual caps. And what the bill would do is, in instances where someone makes a deposit into the 529 account and then subsequently rolls those dollars amount, does a rollover from Oregon's 529 into another state's 529 account, it would more or less disallow that subtraction from taxable income related to those dollars that are being rolled over to another state's 529 account. The amendment, the dash one amendment, is just simply moving the applicability date from January 1st, 2018 to January 1st, 2019.
Thank you. One person signed up to testify. Mr. Parker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon Savings Network. This is a fairly simple bill for us. We've seen many states close what we kind of call a loophole here, where when folks are taking advantage of Oregon's 529 plan and decide to take that tax deduction and then roll the money over, we want to essentially recapture that deduction. We do that now for non-qualified withdrawals or unqualified withdrawals. So if you roll the money out now and use it to buy something else besides higher education, we do recapture as well. So this just extends that that to folks who are putting money into the account and then immediately rolling it out to another state's plan. So we've looked at this over a number of states. A number of states have closed this loophole, and we think it's just good tax policy. If you're going to use our 529 plan and take our tax deduction, we believe you should be keeping your money in our 529 plan. So again, simple bill. With that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Do you know the impact of this? What percent? What total dollars? What are we talking about being moved out?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, I don't have exact numbers. We do hear anecdotally people, you know, doing this. When we look at what other states have done, we've seen where other states have actually closed this as well. But I don't have an exact dollar number because we don't. We track rollovers, so we could probably try to figure out, but then when we track the rollover, we don't know if you've taken the tax deduction or not. So it would be a fairly anecdotal number to get to. Again, this is an extension of the current non-qualified withdrawal, so we just want to add that to make this essentially a non-qualified withdrawal, and you would owe the state back the money that you took in a deduction.
Do you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you. So you don't really have an idea of what the total impact number is, but if someone were to roll it from for the 529 program, if someone were to roll it from Oregon to, let's say, Nevada, mm-hmm. it's still, in the eyes of the federal government, it's a 529, but in eyes of the state, it's no longer a 529 because they're rolling it out.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, yes, in the eyes of everyone, it's still, because if you're rolling it from a qualified plan to a qualified plan, so you would still get the tax-free growth allowed by the federal government. That stays. In Oregon law currently, you can only take the state's tax deduction if you are in Oregon's plan. So we just want to make sure that as you're in Oregon's plan, we're extending that you keep your money here.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rushkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is not a subtraction. What I want to know is if I'm on Oregon's plan and I send my son or daughter to University of Utah, that's okay still? Okay, this is just rolling the money over into, say, like Nevada or Utah's plan. Why would somebody want to do that? Are they getting better returns somewhere else, or what's going on here?
Representative Reschke, I'm not quite sure why they'd want to do that. I think mm-hmm. folks may have an idea that they might like some other plan better. Mm. I can tell you, generally speaking, most 529 plans around the country, and ours now included, invest in low-cost mutual fund index products, so largely the same. The differences by state are going to be how we do the asset allocation, or, you know, what our fees are. Our fees are very low, 1/3 of 1% on an annual basis. So, but again, investors do what they like to do, and we just want to make it fair that if you're going to use our plan and take the state's subtraction, you should keep your money in the state's plan.
Thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. This ultimately, though, will continue to depend on self-reporting, right? So I could take it out and roll it into another state's 529 and just not tell you that that's what I did, right? So it ultimately depends on self-reporting, like so much of our tax system does.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, absolutely. And again, you can even take it out non-qualified and buy a boat and not report it, and we would never know. So it is all self-reported. Correct.
Okay.
Good point.
Well, that does beg the question for what system do we have for auditing at some point?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, yes. I mean, I think we're happy to look at ways to help Department of Revenue figure out that folks are using the plan for its intended purpose.
Thank you. Mr. Easton, do you have any comments on the items that have been discussed during testimony or questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just one thing I'd put in there is the discussion that's been ongoing is trying to identify those that are rolling over and what the impact would be in terms of tax dollars. It's something we'll be working with Treasury Department as well as DOR to see what information we can pull together to see if we can't find a way to get a good estimate, at least, of the dollar impact and the number of taxpayers that are doing such a role.
And then you'll make that available to the committee?
Absolutely. That'd be in the revenue impact statement, yes.
If I could, just one last comment. We are working with Department of Revenue on some technical fixes to this because we want to make sure that it works once the if and when the bill does pass.
Right, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sort of flummoxed by the questions down the row in terms of accountability. So if I put money into a 529, I can take it out and I don't report to you at all what I do with it?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, yes, you have to report to us. Uh-huh. Essentially, you get a 1099 and you take a distribution. Whether you say it's qualified or non-qualified, we don't know unless you're essentially audited. So you have to report to us whether that's a qualified withdrawal for higher education with its intended purpose or non-qualified and using the money for something besides higher education. It's self-reported.
Okay, so we do check a box.
You do.
That says this qualified.
That is correct. You have to essentially not tell the truth. We ask you if it's qualified or non-qualified.
So under the bill, if I'm rolling that over to Nevada, do I have a different box to check, or how does that actually get executed?
Chair Nathan's Representative Marsh, no, we actually can track rollovers because we know what happens with a rollover is you fill out an application, let's say in Nevada, mm-hmm. and Nevada then comes and gets the money from us. So we know when the money is actually rolled from one state to another. Unlike the fact that we don't know once you take a distribution how you use the money. Once it leaves our account and goes to your account, we don't know whether you spend it on higher education or whether you spend it on something else.
So the sure. Follow up. Thank you. So in the case of in this case, it's not entirely self-reported. If Nevada is coming to you to the treasurer's office to the savings plan and reporting that this money has been, that's actually the moment in which we know what's happened.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, yes, but again, it would have to be checked. So you could still say that, you could still not pay the taxes, but it has to be checked on. So again, an audit process, but we do know when plans are rolled over.
Okay.
We can tell you who and how much has been rolled.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions? Anything you need to add before we close the public hearing?
No, Chair Nathanson, again, this is just a bill we think is good, essentially good tax policy, closing a couple loopholes. Other states have done this, and we think it would be good for us to follow suit. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Just a comment for the committee. When we get the number, are we getting a number of how much is going? Because that will tell us if there's something wrong with our plan compared to other states' plans.
Thank you. Anything else? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2388. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2141.
Good morning once again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And House Bill 2141 is it's a lengthy bill, and it's a committee bill that's making changes to how tax credits are transferred. And so the general idea of the changes here is really establishing uniform procedures and uniform requirements for the transfer of tax credits. It's then authorizing the Department of Revenue to prescribe by rule additional procedural requirements for the transfer of these credits. There are some requirements related to certifying agencies, providing information to DOR, and then also requiring or authorizing the director of certifying agencies to suspend or revoke tax credits if in cases where they find something that was not done correctly is the idea. And in a lot of cases with tax credits, just to back up one second, is there's in many cases will be a certifying agency. So if it's a tax credit related to agriculture, then Department of Agriculture might do some certification, and then that documentation goes to Department of Revenue, and then the credit is claimed on the tax return. It would be the underlying bill is applicable to tax credits that are transferred on or after January 1st, 2020.
Thank you. One person signed up to testify, Deanna Mack.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And Kyle did a good job of explaining what House Bill 2141 does. It does do those three things. It applies, like he said, to tax credits. The bill applies as of January 1, 2020, and currently applies to tax credits issued on or after January 1, 2016, as drafted. The changes in this bill, from our point of view, are administrative in nature because, left unchanged, they cause difficulty in administration for the department, for our partner agencies, as well as for taxpayers and tax professionals. Originally, this bill was introduced in 2017 as House Bill 2286. It was a department concept, but it was in committee upon adjournment. We worked really hard on it during the session and with Representative Marsh and then Representative Benz, now Senator, and we just ran out of time. So this version of the bill is actually 2286-4 from 2017. In House Bill 2141. So the goal of this bill is to provide a means for the department to ensure that the taxpayer who is entitled to claim a credit claims it and claims only the total amount certified and not more. We currently do this through a mixed approach of real-time processing and audit, but we want to use automation and make full use of the tools we have in our return processing system. Additionally, capturing this information in electronic format will provide more detailed information to forecasters, such as your LRO staff, to help better understand how these credits are claimed in current and future years. First, House Bill 2141 requires state agencies to inform the department of the tax credits they have certified. We currently have agreements with the various agencies that certify tax credits, but all of them prefer an affirmative requirement in statute to require them to provide this information, mainly because there's Social Security information being transferred. The bill requires agencies to certify tax credits to give us this information about the value and the type of the credit, as well as identifying information about who is eligible to claim the credit. It also requires pass-through entities who earn certified credits to notify the department which of their partners are the credit and in what amount, so we know who they're flowing through to. We then load all that information into what we call our Business Credit Manager, BCM, and so that allows us to process those returns and match them to the credits claimed on those returns in real time, rather than after the fact upon audit. The bill also provides for uniform procedures for the clawback of a credit when the certifying agency determines that the person is no longer eligible. Currently, the various tax credits have different provisions for how and when a credit should be revoked. This bill makes it clear there must be an order issued by the certifying agency and appealed with that agency through the contested case process under Chapter 183. Upon a final order, then the department will get notice of that and will bill back the taxpayer for the amount of credit they've already claimed that reflects the revoked or rescinded amount. If the credit was transferred, the transferee, so the person who paid for the credit, would be held harmless, and the person who sold the credit, the transferor, would be the one who's billed back, because the transferee is, you know, they're innocent in this whole thing. So finally, the bill requires uniformity in how the tax credits are transferred. The person who earns the credit and the person who intends to claim the credit must notify the department within certain time frames. And as the bill is currently drafted, if a credit is claimed over several years, the transferor may transfer the entire credit or the entire portion of a credit that is specific to each tax year. So, for example, if the total credit is $6,000 and it's claimed over 4 years, the transfer may transfer the entire $6,000. They may transfer the $1,500 increments to one or more transferees. They may not use a part of the $1,500 on their own return for a given year and then transfer the balance, or transfer part of the $1,500 to multiple transferees. They must transfer the entire $1,500 to one transferee. However, they may transfer each section that of the $1,500 increment to different people, if that makes sense. If they take $1,500 on one return and they only have an $800 liability, then they have $700 to carry forward following the provisions in whichever particular credit is applicable. At the time this bill was originally drafted, there were still 6 credits that were transferable. 4 have since sunset. However, they are still listed in House Bill 2141. So currently there are only 2 active credits that may be transferred to another taxpayer, the agricultural workforce housing and bovine manure. And we worked with those agencies. They were at the time satisfied with 2286-4, but we continue. We want to show them amendments to this to make sure that they're still good with this once we correct some of these things for the energy credits. Any new transferable credits that would fall under these provisions going forward if the bill were to pass. So if you guys come up with any new ideas, then they would fall under these uniform things. In spite of the fact that those energy credits have sunset, the clawback provisions do still need to apply to those expired credits in the event the certifying agency must rescind them for, you know, an already earned credit because of fraud, malfeasance, mistake or representation, or if the taxpayer violates some other provision of the rules that allows for the credit. Since 2017, the transfer and reporting language under 2286-4 also was brought over to the bovine manure credit, which passed in 2017 and then was later amended in 2018. So that language that's in that was in House Bill 4028 should be made part of 2141 for the bovine manure credit. But we believe that uniformity is key in the ability to administer these various tax credits effectively. We think uniformity will improve our ability to ensure the tax credits are being claimed properly and provide a better understanding for what is claimed and what is left to be claimed, that tail that we're always talking about. In fact, in Iowa was recently recognized by the Federation of Tax Administrators for doing implementing just the same thing in 2017. The FTA said that their system has the potential to improve revenue forecasting by providing detailed information on tax credit awards and their use, enabling forecasters to better understand how credits are claimed in current and future years. So in addition to what I described earlier, there are a few other conformity amendments that we need to address relating to tax-exempt entities and the department's rulemaking authority. So we ask that you give us permission to work on amendments with Legislative Revenue Office and LC to reflect what I've discussed today. And we ask that you support our goal of uniformity in the tax credit administration. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, I hope.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So I support uniformity in tax credits, but you said a couple things that give me a little bit of pause. One is that, you know, the two programs already part of agriculture programs, I would assume, that are still credits hanging out there, the bovine tax credit and ag workforce housing. And where is ag's position on House Bill 2141 as it stands?
Madam Chair, Representative Finley, they were at the end of 2017 okay with 2286-4, but I spoke with them this morning. They have not yet reviewed the 2141 to ensure that it's the same, but they believe they are. But they are in the room, so if you want to ask them.
Okay. Yeah. I think that would be worthwhile. So, thank you.
Is there someone from the agency who could come up and speak to that question?
Oh, maybe they left. Sorry.
I have a question.
Yes.
Because there's time. Could you please give me a really brief primer on the topic of multiple transferees?
Multiple transferees.
And since there are rules about you, when you can and when you can't do it, what's the reason behind the rule?
Well, Madam Chair, the reason behind that is a policy decision. That was one of the things that we worked through in 2017 with Reps Marsh and Senator Bentz, because we view that as a policy decision. You can transfer a part of the credit and then also transfer the carry forward, but it seems cleaner to do that, just transfer the whole portion of the credit and allow them to take it in a year-by-year basis. But that's a policy decision. If you want to do something different, we're happy to continue that discussion.
I would like to follow up and ask, is it more of an administrative concern or a concern for fairness? What's behind that choice?
Representative Nathanson, Chair Nathanson, I think that it might be more of a burden for taxpayers because they would have to notify us of every time there's a transfer. And so if you have a $1,500 credit and you're only transferring $200 at a time, then there's going to be several forms that they have to send to us to notify us of that transfer. We can do that, but it's kind of maybe cost prohibitive for them, or maybe they don't, I don't really know, but it's not, that component isn't an administrative burden for us, but not knowing who they're being transferred to is, and that's why we want the provisions that require them to notify us.
That's helpful. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a cost to all these changes then? So if you're going to make everything uniform, we hope it will streamline tracking these. But sounds like there's going to be some setup costs, or am I wrong on that?
Actually, Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, we, like I said earlier, we have agreements with our partner agencies where they're already providing that data to us. So we've already built that system in our return processing system. So there isn't a cost for us to do that. That's already been done.
Okay. And just to follow up, so do you know if there'll be costs on the other end, the reporting agency? So they're already doing this, so there won't, you don't foresee any additional costs to those agencies?
No, okay. Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, no, I don't foresee that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I assume that we will hear from the other agency.
Yeah, I will let her know.
Maybe directly and not through you.
We'll let her know.
I think we need to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else on this bill? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2141. There is no other work before us this morning that I'm aware of. I'm adjourning.